From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is made in a visit. Today, Lieutenant Governor Kathy Hochul visiting the Rochester area. On her way through town, stopping into Connections this hour. And a short visit in Rochester, a short visit on Connections, but we're always thrilled to have the time. And Kathy Hochul in studio with us. Great to see you here. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Delighted to have the invitation.
Before we get into some of the really hot state issues, obviously economic development's a very hot issue. Tell us why you're in Rochester today.
Well, I co-chair the Regional Economic Development Councils, and today we had the meeting of the Finger Lakes Council, which is a very dynamic group. They have not just the people that the governor appointed 3-4 years ago, but 400 individuals from the community who've stepped up to participate on 20 different advisory groups. So this area, it really takes this seriously. They're very competitive, and they're really excited about the opportunity to win a chance at the $1.5 billion competition.
Yeah, there's upstate divided into seven sections. Three, my understanding, will win $500 million pots of money later this year?
Yes.
We'll know.
Applications, actually today we're just announcing that the applications are available online May 1st. The process is beginning, and we look forward to having the final applications due in October and decisions made by the end of the year. So they're very, very focused on coming up with a transformative project that's going to touch all the counties involved in the regional competition.
Now, I don't know who will win the other two, but there's zero chance Rochester Finger Lakes doesn't win one of the three, right?
That's certainly what they think here. There's a lot of energy.
Zero chance. I say that, I mean, in all seriousness, I would be shocked. Would you be surprised if this region didn't win one of the three?
All I would say is I just sat between Joel Seligman, your president at the University of Rochester, and Danny Wegman, and they're very fired up about this. They want to win this, and they know it could be a game changer. This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, the largest investment by the state of New York in upstate revitalization and economic development, and our governor is so committed to this. And he wants to have every region thrive, but he's going to say, you show me your best. You put your best forward. That's why the competitive nature of this really has borne a lot of fruit. In fact, in the last 4 years, Rochester has been a top winner multiple times, over $350 million, 320 projects in this area. So Rochester, Finger Lakes, I should say, have done extremely well in this competition so far.
If our listeners think I'm being flippant when I say that I'll host the show standing on my head if Rochester Finger Lakes doesn't win one of these, it's because there have been Kathy Hochul, who is here, has Buffalo roots. And for years, Rochester has had a bit of a hard feeling about what they perceive as to be inequality. They've seen big economic state aid disparity. They've seen the Buffalo Billion, the so-called Buffalo Billion. And maybe you can finally settle in terms that are very clear for our listeners why Buffalo was given so much more for so long.
Well, I wouldn't say for so long. I would say this is making up for an area that's been neglected by the state legislature for over 50 years. I would have to tell you that in Buffalo, a very blue-collar town based on steel industry, where my grandfather and father worked at Bethlehem Steel, when those jobs left in 1983, the economy tanked, and they never really recovered until the governor started investing it. We were always looking down the thruway at Rochester, jealous of Eastman and Kodak and Bausch & Lomb and all the businesses here. So you had a very robust, high-tech, innovative culture that we didn't have at all. And so we had a few large industries leave, and that wiped us out. So the governor really went to the hardest hit area of the state. And he said, if we can turn around Buffalo, we can do it anywhere. And I can attest, if anybody has not been to downtown Buffalo recently, you need to come. The waterfront's been revitalized. The jobs are there. And that is exactly the formula that he is now taking to the rest of the state with these competitions. And in fact, the person who was in charge of the Buffalo Billion, Howard Zemsky, has now been placed in charge of economic development for the entire state. So he is going to bring best practices, ideas, and tell the Buffalo story everywhere. So in Buffalo, what you see down there is only about half of the $1 billion has actually been spent. So you can see what $500 million of investment leveraged 5-to-1 with private sector investment looks like. So that is the vision that we're trying to share with the rest of the state, and the governor is very committed to this.
Talking to Kathy Hochul, Lieutenant Governor, who's stopping into the studio today on our way through Western New York. And we've talked on this program about an hour last week on Startup New York. And most of the participants on this program concluded we need more time to assess, that some of the criticism has been premature, that it's in year one. But then there are also questions that say, if this program becomes wildly successful, let's say it creates 5,000 jobs in 5 years, the state's already spent roughly $50 million on ads promoting it. Did the state have to spend that much promoting this program?
I'll tell you why they need to spend that much, because we're trying to attract businesses and interests from all over the country. And I'm so excited that just before I came on your show, I saw that Forbes announced that New York State has surpassed California in startups. It's been a long time in coming, and we are much further down the list a few years ago. But the Startup in New York program, which allows new companies or companies that are willing to expand within the state, tax-free opportunities, no income tax, no property tax, no sales tax for 10 years, that gives us a strategic and competitive advantage when we're looking with the other 49 states. And I know that it works. I was in Washington recently trying to attract businesses from all over the world to come to New York, and this was the tool that I had in my toolkit that made the difference. So we are, you talk about 5,000 jobs. We already have commitments for 3,100 jobs already. So we need a little more time, but it is starting to burst. And that advertising had to go national, because we don't need to tell our story within the state. We need to tell it across the country.
Mike Durant with the National Federation of Independent Business says, hey, if you can create jobs in one sense, that's great, but it feels like picking winners and losers, when he would have liked to see, and he says the business community would have liked to see, a broad-based tax cut that doesn't just pick one sector, one location. He feels like it leaves a lot of people out, and he says government's got a very bad history with winners and losers, whether it's corn-based ethanol or empire zones. Does the government have a bad record of picking winners and losers?
Well, previously, New York State had a bad-for-business reputation before the governor said, I'm turning that around. He has absolutely lived up to the slogan of, we are open for business, and part of that was cutting taxes. So I think the business community, who's willing to listen and understand what's going on, they know that we now have some of the lowest taxes we've ever had in our lifetime. We have no upstate manufacturing tax any longer. That was eliminated by this governor and legislature. We've also have the lowest corporate income tax since 1917. So yes, we understand that we are perceived as a high-tech state. That's why the governor has cut taxes, but that's not enough. We have to bring new energy, new startups, and that's why we have surpassed California as number one in the country for startups, and that is a brand new announcement just came out today.
We've got a few more minutes with Lieutenant Governor Kathy Hochul, who is stopping in Rochester today, and you have been passionate about the sexual assault legislation that we see at the state level now. Briefly explain for our listeners, if this passes, how does it work? What does it change?
What the governor wants to do is have a statewide system of rights for women who are, or women and men who are survivors of sexual assault, starting with a definition of consent that is applicable and uniform. Because right now, no matter what campus you're on, you could be subjected to different rules, different standards, and that's really not fair. So we want to have one definition of what consent is. It has to be affirmative consent, because what happens, you get a
verbalized?
Verbalized, because here's what happens, and I've heard this from survivors when I've been all over the campuses of this state. Young women go to a party. They can be drugged. They can be inebriated and not in capacity to say yes or no. And someone could take advantage of them and say, well, she never said no. Well, that's because she's passed out. But under the current standards, well, he's not guilty. She didn't say no. We flipped that right upside down. And the survivors are so happy that we now give them more power to say, yes, I control this relationship. And if I'm not saying yes, that means no. But there's more to it than that. Another part is important is amnesty. A lot of times young people are at a gathering, whether it's on a fraternity or sorority, in an environment where there's underage drinking, which violates policy and law. And they're afraid to come forward with their stories of what's happened to them or what they saw happen to a friend because of repercussions. And the governor says, we're going to remove that. There is amnesty for someone who comes forward to talk about this, because for too long, this has been swept in the shadows. We need to bring this out into broad daylight and talk about it. Similar to domestic violence. People didn't talk about that for decades. And now people are starting to say, this is not acceptable. We're finally getting to that point with sexual assault. Part of the program is also training, a Bill of Rights, and also making sure that any victim is aware of any resources available to them. So that's the policy right now at SUNY schools with this legislation that we need everyone to contact their state legislators to support by the end of this year, by the end of June. We want to make sure this is uniform, not just SUNY, but apply to private schools all over New York as well. And our governor is very committed to getting this done.
What are private schools telling you? Can they deal with this kind of a uniform policy? Can they enforce it?
Yes, they can. SUNY has the role model. They have all sizes of schools, and suburban, rural, urban areas, and they said, we've done it, and you can do it as well. I just hosted a roundtable at Syracuse University last week. They have signed on 100% with this policy. The chancellor has convened his own advisory group to make sure that they're adhering to it properly. So there are a lot of privates that are stepping up, but there's others who aren't. And this law would apply to everyone in the state, and we want to get it passed by June 17, the end of session.
Here's one of the criticisms. Kathy Young is an editor for Reason magazine, and here's what she wrote in Time magazine under a piece called Having the Government Dictate How People Should Behave in Sexual Encounters is a Terrible Idea. She says that there is a concern that in without that, well, let me just read what she says, and we'll get Kathy's response here. Quote, no sane person would quarrel with the principle that sex without consent is rape and should be severely punished. But while sexual consent is widely defined as an absence of no, except in cases of incapacitation, anti-rape activists and many feminists have long argued that this definition needs to shift toward an active yes. It would turn people into unwitting rapists every time they have sex without obtaining an explicit yes. And furthermore, such rules are unlikely to protect anyone from sexual assault. The activists often cite a scenario in which a woman submits without saying no because she's paralyzed by fear. Yet the perpetrator in such a case is very likely to be a sexual predator, not a clueless guy making an innocent mistake. And there's nothing to stop him from lying and claiming that he obtained explicit consent. As for sex with an incapacitated victim, it is already not only a violation of college codes of conduct, but a felony. What do you say to that?
I say I have heard the voices of victims, survivors all across the state. When I lay out the governor's proposal, they are so grateful that Governor Cuomo has stepped up and says, we are putting the power in these young women, particularly women, and saying you have a right to say no, but also there is no assumed consent. And that is liberating for them. They want to know that they have certain rights. And yes, there are people that are going to oppose this and have different points of view, but I'm going by what the survivors want. And they want their state government to protect them. And our governor wants to make sure the state of New York is number one in the nation in protecting young women, and in some cases, young men, from sexual assault on campuses.
Last brief question for you, and I know you got to get out the door. You've been in government in a number of different levels, and now here you are as lieutenant governor. We've seen a lot of talk about ethics reform. Are you satisfied from where you work in Albany that the people you work with in the legislature are now being essentially subject to rules that will hold them accountable, or are there still loopholes that you're concerned about?
We always want to do more. The governor laid out a very ambitious plan of ethics reform, and what he did this year builds on reform from the previous years. So now we've outlawed bribery. Believe it or not, it was not outlawed. Disclosure is so important. For the first time ever, the constituents will have a right to know who is paying the fees, if you're an attorney or in other professions, of your legislators, because there's an inherent conflict of interest. And this is what the governor wanted to get at. And we've changed that culture now, is that someone could be buying influence and trying to get legislation changed in their favor and hiring someone as an attorney. We are now saying we will know about that. We will have you disclose any fees you make over $1,000, and you'll disclose the names over $5,000. So there's much more transparency. Is the job done? No. We also have pension reform, because it is abhorrent to our taxpayers and the governor that people have been convicted of crimes while they're in office are able to still collect a state pension. That is going to change, but that takes a little longer because that has to go through the constitutional change. But I think the state will support that. So we'll never rest on our laurels. The governor will continue to press for meaningful ethics reform, but the challenge is he lays out a compelling vision where he wants to go, but you have to get the legislators to really, in a sense, vote against their own interest in enacting these, and that has been the challenge, but this year there were some breakthroughs.
Lieutenant Governor Kathy Hochul, thank you for your time. I know it is a busy day for you, and we'll see you back in here on another occasion, I'm sure.
I look forward to it. Thank you.
Lieutenant Governor Hochul, she has to vacate the studio now and hit the road, and I'm going to welcome our news director, Randy Gorbman, to the studio now on this busy Thursday afternoon. Thank you, Lieutenant Governor. And I should mention to our listeners, I know the phone rang at one point here, on this sort of a short visit. Mm-hmm. We couldn't arrange for phone calls. It was an agreement we made with the lieutenant governor. We wanted to honor that request from her, especially given the short nature of time. But our hope is that she will come back and that we will be able to
hopefully
to take
a full hour, and then definitely we'll try to get some conversation.
It's valuable to us, and our intention is not to to do anything that would sort of impede that. But if we want, with our news director Randy Gorbin here, let me at least grab the one person who's been on hold the longest, and that's Bob and Henrietta. And I know Bob, I certainly, as the host of this program, I apologize for the fact that the Lieutenant Governor asked that we don't take calls just in given the short visit. But I do want you to let you weigh in with your thoughts here. Go ahead.
Well, thank you. Obviously, I can understand her circumstances of not wanting to take the time to answer questions. But I want to raise a point that probably is more relevant to the segment that's coming up with Maggie Garrett from American Center for Separation of Church and State, which is that there are bills in the legislature and a proposal that has come from the Governor Cuomo to allow the existence of tuition tax credits in New York State, which means that an individual can donate money up to $1 million to a private school, primarily religious schools, and take at least a 75%, in some proposals, a 90% credit off their state income tax. That seems to me to be basically a backdoor voucher. Money that would have gone to the state coffers to be used for educational purposes is being diverted and drained from the state to be used by private schools. That seems to violate a basic principle of separation of church and state. And I was interested in understanding what Lieutenant Governor Hochul's views were on that matter.
Well, I appreciate the question on this. It certainly sounds like something that you have spent some time studying and looking into. Have you seen any indication that state leaders are aware or concerned about this, Bob?
Oh, yeah. It's a very controversial matter. I mean, it's been supported by a number of people in both the Senate and the Assembly. Some versions of this have already passed. But there are other legislative leaders who are very concerned. I think it's a bad idea to divert funds from public schools, which are in pretty tough financial circumstances nowadays, to divert those funds to private schools. It's like a voucher, which would be a state-sponsored tuition grant that allows students to attend private schools rather than public schools on taxpayer dollars.
Well, Bob, thanks for the call. And Bob's right. In just a few minutes, we're going to be hearing from Maggie Garrett with Americans United for the Separation of Church and State. The legislative director was in Rochester this week speaking to the local chapter, and so that interview is coming up in just a moment. So Bob brings up one issue that he'd like to hear the state address. The session goes until June, and you heard Kathy Hochul say there are certain things she wants to see get done by June. And then in the fall, we'll see the awards of those $500 million pools, the three different pools. And Randy, I said on this program to the Lieutenant Governor, I just can't see any scenario where Rochester Finger Lakes isn't awarded one of those three, particularly in light of the fact that this community has been smarting for a while about what they perceive as disparity between Rochester and Buffalo.
And as you know, at least for the last few years, Evan, the argument, including that of the governor, has been in the past, Rochester is doing better than some of the other upstate communities. At least that was the justification given by the Cuomo administration as to why maybe we didn't get more at times than some other places. So it's kind of like, you look at it in a balance. Well, are you doing better? But then we feel like we're slighted. What I found, I just wanted to bring up real briefly, is an interesting article by Jimmy Vielkind, who we've had on occasionally from publication Capital New York. And, this is a really hot competition for that upstate fund. And Jimmy says today that apparently a lot of regions, maybe even the Finger Lakes, you're still thinking about it, may actually hire consultants, actually spend money. I don't know where exactly the money's going to come from, maybe from whatever pot of money they received before, hire consultants to get a better chance at winning part of that money.
I'm not surprised, mm-hmm. because when you look at, for example, the casino competition, there was all kinds of bids, and that proposal process undoubtedly had consultants as well. I mean, we're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars, mm-hmm. and they're going to be willing to invest and try to win it. Even with the best consultants, if all seven regions have them, I just can't believe Rochester Finger Lakes doesn't end up with that. You heard Kathy Hochul say that she sat between Joel Seligman and Danny Wegman today. They're part of the Economic Development Council. There's a lot of clout pushing for this region to end up with one of those grants.
There's a lot of clout, and certainly, we have done better or worse some years with the regular fund, the regular economic development pot of money, which is also, as you mentioned, coming out later this year. I would think, and again, even though he's technically restricted by, in some cases, from lobbying, you would think Bob Duffy, former lieutenant governor, very close to the administration.
He's not supposed to do that yet
supposed to
for
do
a
that,
couple of years, I think.
But they know, obviously, who he is. Makes himself very clear in comments. You have to think that's going to have an influence.
You're not making an allegation.
I'm not making any allegations. I'm making a small inference.
An observation. Yeah. Observation. No, I think a lot of people, I kid, but a lot of people have made that observation. Bob Duffy went straight from the lieutenant governor's office to the Rochester Business Alliance. And yeah, he's not supposed to lobby for 2 years. And I take him certainly at his word about that. But there is so much clout for this community. We're going to hear Veronica Volk was down covering the
lieutenant
governor's
She'll be reporting, and it really, you know, literally these are like 2-plus-hour meetings. So she tweeted a little bit this morning, but she really wants to do a more in-depth story this afternoon. So you'll hear that on WXXI News, as well as read it later on WXXINews.org later this afternoon.
And I also mentioned that last week on this program, we had an hour-long discussion on Startup New York. We asked the lieutenant governor about that. If you missed that, all of the programs are podcasted, WXXINews.org/connections. That was certainly an interesting discussion with a number of different stakeholders. I mentioned National Federation of Independent Business, which does not like in their words, the government picking winners and losers. But we also had the state director of that program. We had Kent Gardner, a local economist, who cautioned patience on this program. And today, the lieutenant governor put up a figure I had not heard before. She said 3,100 jobs already committed. We've been hearing somewhere around 2,500 jobs. So there's certainly a lot of pressure on that number to go up. But again, I suspect, Randy, we're going to see some movement on that.
I think so. And realizing, and again, not making excuses for anybody, but I mean, I understand the argument that it did get underway kind of later in the year last year. A lot of these things, and I don't know exactly which jobs Lieutenant Governor was talking about, but I think in general she's trying to get to the point these are in the pipeline, may not have been realized yet. I guess you can go back maybe a year or two from now and say, did it really realize that kind of benefit?
Yeah. Well, they know that this will be vetted and analyzed for return on investment very closely. Thank you, Randy.
Sure.
Randy Gorman, news director for WXXI. We have a short break now. And again, when we come back, it's going to be Maggie Garrett. She sits down with me to talk about the legislative perspective from the national group, Americans United for Separation of Church and State. That is next on Connections. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Americans United for the Separation of Church and State is an organization that seeks to make sure religion and government are not intertwined, that religion is not codified in public policy, that public policy is not driven or created for religion. In this country, Americans United for the Separation of Church and State will look at local issues, state issues, and federal issues. And in our area, last year, Americans United for the Separation of Church and State became involved with that case known as the Greasetown case, the town prayer case there that you might remember so well. Well, now the National Legislative Director for Americans United, Maggie Garrett, is visiting Rochester this week. She spoke on Monday night to the local chapter of Americans United for the Separation of Church and State. She wanted to present the legislative priorities for the organization and kind of give a sense of what could be coming up in the next election cycle. Certainly the presidential elections. We'll talk a lot about these issues. We want to know also what her experience has been working with the Obama administration. Where has the Obama administration done well in the eyes of Americans United for the Separation of Church and State? And where has the Obama administration fallen short in their eyes? Let me welcome Maggie Garrett to Connections.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
A lot going on nationally, I should say, state by state, but some of the issues have become national issues. A lot of people are looking at Indiana, for example, with Governor Pence and the law there. And that is a legislature that reacted pretty quickly to public opinion, I think. How did you, what do you make of the public backlash to the Indiana law?
I thought it was really interesting and about time, actually, because these bills have actually been coming up in the states for several years. And those of us at Americans United have been warning people, be careful about these bills. They came up many, many years ago with good intentions, but now after a lot of some of the case law that's been happening because of the backlash that some people are having towards marriage equality happening, these bills are now being manipulated in ways that they weren't in the past. And so we have been warning people, and we have been opposing bills like this in the states for many years because of our fear about how they will be used to discriminate against other people.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about that history and what's been happening in other states before we talk a little bit more specifically about Indiana. Some of the defenders of the Indiana law have said, why is there a backlash now? There are other states where this has been happening. You can go back to Bill Clinton in 1993. They point to all different manner of reasons to defend it. And they say, why now? How do you answer that question?
I think that there's finally a realization of how the bills can be used. And in some places, there are actually more protections for LGBT people than there used to be. So we didn't really have this problem of having a RFRA overturn non-discrimination laws because there weren't non-discrimination laws many years ago when many of these bills were passed to begin with. Plus, it never occurred to anybody when RFRA was passed on the federal level, let alone in the beginning in the states, that it would possibly be used to discriminate against other people. It just was never even in people's imaginations, I don't think.
It's interesting because some of the defenders of the Indiana law have said, sure it was. We're just seeing a cultural shift in the country that is changing the way we expect to legislate on this. But you're saying you don't think it was in people's minds.
I don't think it was in people's minds. I mean, not, it was certainly not in people's minds like Americans United and the ACLU and other groups like that who supported that bill in Congress. When we supported, and actually if you look at the legislative history, if you look at what they were talking about on the floor in Congress, they were talking about things like there needs to be protections for kids who want to wear a yarmulke to public schools and they need protection against a rule that doesn't allow them to wear headgear. We need protections for Catholic churches in dry counties who want to make sure that they can serve communion wine. We need protections for the Orthodox Jewish community who don't want autopsies, things like that. Another thing that came up was kosher food, and it was even regulations on the production of meat and whether or not that could interfere with kosher food laws. Those were the things that people were talking about on the floor of Congress. They were not talking about non-discrimination laws or anything like the people who are supporting state RFRAs are now talking about.
I thought it was telling watching Governor Mike Pence talk to George Stephanopoulos when he wouldn't answer the question about whether the law in Indiana would allow discrimination against gay and lesbian couples, gay and lesbian people. But he did say it is about protecting freedom. It was about protecting the freedom of the religious community, and they have felt under assault in many ways. When you see that kind of an interview, and he's saying, first and foremost, that law is not about discriminating. It's about protecting freedom. No?
No. I mean, I suppose it's how you look at it, right? But he also said it's not about discrimination. But if you look at a lot of supporters of the law, a lot of the rhetoric that was surrounding that bill, same thing happened last year in Arizona. A lot of the rhetoric that goes along with it is the fear that people are having because of marriage equality. So they're looking at the advancement that the LGBT community is having, and their response is fear. And so that's how they're responding to this. But of course, it really isn't harming anyone to give equality to others.
In Arkansas, my understanding is there was at least a similar bill, and I don't know where it is. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
In Arkansas, they were actually going through the process at the very same time. And so it was overshadowed a lot by the Indiana bill and a lot of the press that it was getting. But what they did in Arkansas was they changed the language so it directly mirrors the federal RFRA. So it doesn't have a non-discrimination provision in it like the Indiana law. It just mirrors the federal law. But of course, we have lots of concerns with the federal law as well. And so in our mind, that isn't enough. The door is still open to discriminating against LGBT people, and the door is still open to harming women's health.
Did Indiana, quote unquote, fix it? Did their legislative?
No.
It's still an issue.
We would say that it is not fixed. It was a vast improvement to what they originally had drafted and what originally had gone through before Pence told them to fix it. But it doesn't go far enough, in my mind, to actually prevent it from discriminating against others. And there's two main problems I see with it. One is it does say that you can't discriminate on it has sort of a listed categories of ways you cannot discriminate, but it's not broad enough. But the bigger problem in my mind from looking at the bill is there's a really big exemption from kind of from the exemption that says that religious organizations can still use it to discriminate. And the way it is drafted to me is too broad.
So in other words, you're not satisfied with what Indiana's done, but it looks like they're kind of closing the book on this.
That's correct. Yeah, the governor has signed it. That is the law in Indiana. But to me, it's not good enough.
Okay.
And it's not good enough just because it's not good enough that the non-discrimination provision isn't good enough. But it also doesn't do anything for the problem of how RFRAs can affect women's health. And that's the whole Hobby Lobby situation, which did not make a big splash in the press at the end about how RFRAs can now harm women.
Okay. Explain a little bit more on that then.
Okay. So the Hobby Lobby case, that's the case that says that for-profit corporations can deny women health insurance coverage for contraception using RFRA. A lot of people don't realize that this is a RFRA case. It's a Religious Freedom Restoration Act case. A lot of people think it just came under the First Amendment, but it's actually a RFRA case. And so now under the federal RFRA, for-profit corporations can claim that they have that they need a religious exemption, that they have somehow a religion, a corporation has a religion that they need to be exempt from laws and because of that religion. And so these state bills are now taking that with them, right? So the state bills apply to corporations, and the state bills allow corporations and individuals to deny women health care that they really need.
When it comes to possible fixes, for example, what is on the legislative menu then that you're supporting that could, in the views of Americans United for Separation of Church and State, what could fix that?
We think there needs to be a clause that would say that RFRA not only can't be used to discriminate against others, but also cannot be used to deny women health care. The way we look at these bills is we believe in having accommodations for religion. What we don't believe in is in having accommodations for religion that can harm other people. Your right to have religious freedom ends when it's harming me and taking away my rights. That's not what religious freedom is.
Senator Tom Cotton, our listeners will know that name from Arkansas. He was the one who was largely behind the letter that was sent to Iran, signed by 47 senators. He actually weighed in on the question of Arkansas looking at a similar law to Indiana. And Senator Cotton said that we are being way too hyperbolic about this, that my goodness, in Iran, you can get killed for being gay. And he said that in Iran, you could get killed for being gay, and we're hardly Iran. So don't we need to have a little perspective on this?
I think that's a pretty low bar for us to have, right? I mean, I would hope that we would look to protect people in the United States a little bit better than that. And, you know, I think things, as people are getting more familiar, they have more gay friends, the more people they know are married. It's in many states, and the world hasn't ended in those states because marriage is provided for same-sex couples. I think people are more and more understanding that it isn't the end of the world. And when they hear people complain, you're violating my rights by you getting married, I think people realize that that's kind of ridiculous.
And the other defense of Indiana, Arkansas, Arizona that we often hear is on grounds of the free market. Some say, look, that pizzeria that was famous in Indiana saying, well, they would not cater a gay wedding. Well, a lot of people said, well, gay weddings probably wouldn't order pizza. But regardless, they said they wouldn't do it. They faced a lot of backlash. And some people have said, well, if they say they won't do it and you don't like it, don't patronize their business. Don't make the law affect what they can and can't do. Let the free market decide, and they will eventually go out of business if people don't like their practice.
I think we decided a long time ago that there are certain things that are just too important to us as Americans to allow to happen with our businesses. We've had non-discrimination laws for a long time, and we've just said it's just not proper to run your business that way, and we're just not going to allow it. And I think this is one of those things. We have gotten to the point where we realize that you shouldn't be turning away someone from the lunch counter because they're a woman. You shouldn't be doing it because of their race, and you shouldn't be doing it because they're gay.
Talking to Maggie Garrett, Legislative Director for Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Works out of Washington. She's in Rochester this week at the invitation of the local chapter. Doing what this week?
Tonight I will be speaking to our local chapter about legislation around the country and in Congress, things that we've been fighting for and against with Congress, with the Obama administration, and some of the interesting things that are happening in the states.
Well, we're going to talk a little bit more about that in just a moment here. But I also think that as we look forward, it's not just about legislation in Congress, but the presidential election already has a lot of rhetoric about God. And we've seen Ted Cruz invoking a creator in just about everything he does. And I want to get your feeling on what Rand Paul said. Rand Paul said recently in an interview that government can't be part of religion, but religion can be part of government. And that's sort of a nebulous statement. I mean, as a legislative director, maybe there isn't much you can say about that. But does that rhetoric concern you?
We are concerned. We're always concerned about how much religion comes up in elections. And one concern we have about that is how it trivializes religion. It is, I think, insulting the way people are using religion to gain political points with voters. So it's not good for religion for people to be talking this way about religion. So that's one problem with it. But the other problem is they're trying to out-religion each other in many cases. And that shouldn't be part of our public policy. We should be voting on people based on their policies, what is good for our country, not whether or not we consider them to be religious enough or not.
Are you looking at the landscape of the 2016 election? Do you follow sort of the debates and these kind of conversations, or is it really more just about actual legislative proposals?
You know, we of course are watching it. We don't endorse any candidates because of our role, but we definitely do watch it. And one of the things that we are always concerned about in presidential elections is the issue of church endorsements. That is sort of a big issue in the church-state world, and the issue there is that churches, just like all other nonprofits, aren't allowed to endorse candidates.
Oh, they do that every cycle, though.
Well,
not all of them.
They get involved a lot, and AU follows this, and we send lots of letters to the IRS. We actually sent a letter to the IRS after Ted Cruz's announcement speech because he went to Liberty University, which is a nonprofit university school. And, you know, everyone was forced to be there. The students had to attend, and he announced his candidacy. And so we saw that was a pretty strong endorsement, we thought, using the university's facilities and mandatory attendance. And so we did send a letter to the IRS on that. So we get
any response on that?
As far as I know, no.
Do they usually respond to stuff like that?
You know what? I am not the person they respond to, so I'm not exactly sure. But they've put a hold on enforcing this provision in the IRS lately. I mean, there's been a lot of turmoil in the IRS, as I'm sure you were following a few months ago. And this is one particular issue where they've really stopped enforcing it. And so part of what our message in our letter said was, this looks really problematic, and you should really start enforcing this as the election restarts. There's regulations that there was a court case, and there's regulations that the Obama administration had put in place as to how to designate that person, but they've never actually been finalized. And then there was a lawsuit, and they said they were going to finalize it. So that was part of our letter, was saying you need to get on the ball and do something about this.
Very interesting. And bringing up the Obama administration, for those who would assume that your organization is typically on the same side as them, our listeners might forget that, if I'm remembering correctly, the Obama administration was on the side of the town of Greece, for example, last year when it came to the complainants, one an atheist, one a Jewish woman, saying that that they didn't like really Christian denomination prayers leading town meetings. The Obama administration was on the side of the town, weren't they?
That is correct. Well, their brief seemed to cite that there should be some protections when there are prayers at government meetings.
Were you disappointed in that?
Yes, yes. I mean, there have been quite a few things the Obama administration has done that have disappointed us. Actually, one of the biggest things that they've done is, or actually not done, is that they haven't fixed the Bush faith-based initiative. I'm not sure how familiar you are.
No, refresh us. That's an important point, and goes back a little way. So refresh us on that.
So the social service programs, social service providers that are religious, they have a long tradition and history of working with the government. But pre-90s, they had to perform the same way that secular groups did. They couldn't discriminate in hiring. They had to perform secular services. There were all sorts of church-state protections that went along with it. And then in the 90s, there were some rumblings to change it. And when the Bush administration came in, George W. Bush came in, he actually changed all of the regulations that controlled working with social service providers that were religious, and he knocked down tons of church-state protections, and he also created a rule saying that religious organizations can take taxpayer money to perform social services, and they can discriminate in hiring with that money for the jobs. So essentially, it is taxpayer-funded discrimination. Your money going out to a job that says, we will only hire Christians, we will only hire people who are Jewish, that we, of course, find really, really troubling. When Obama was running for office, he said he would fix that because you can never justify taxpayer discrimination. And yet we sit here today and, you know, millions and millions of dollars have gone out in social service projects and they can discriminate in hiring with that money.
And do they?
Yes, some groups do. I mean, it's very hard to find out the details of who does and who doesn't. It's hard to get through and find the transparency there. But we're pretty certain. I mean, at least one group wrote to the Bush administration and said, there's a statutory law. Actually, it takes us back to RFRA. There's a statutory provision here that says, I can't discriminate if I take this money, but I really want to take this money. And the Bush administration has, it's a little bit complicated, but they have this thing called an OLC memo. It's the Office of Legal Counsel that provides opinions for the government, for the administration. And they said, oh, RFRA, the same thing we're talking about in Indiana and Arkansas, RFRA says that this would burden your religion. And so you just get out of these non-discrimination provisions. So under that, even if there's a statutory provision that says you can't discriminate using government money, under this policy you can. And the Obama administration, who could fix it very easily, it's probably the easiest thing they could do, hasn't touched it.
Okay. And this is a question you might not be able to answer, but why haven't they touched it?
I'm not sure. It's actually very frustrating to us because he said he was going to when he went into office, and then it just didn't happen. It could be some of the politics at the beginning of his administration, again, you know, talking about religion in elections, where there was all sorts of things thrown at him that he, you know, wasn't a Christian, that he wasn't Christian enough, and all of those, that sort of thing, that swirling around him. I think he might have been afraid to touch anything involving religion in the beginning.
Interesting. Yeah, interesting. And I have to remember as a host, and our listeners should remember, that Americans United for Separation of Church and State is not an atheist organization.
Correct.
It's about just understanding the distinction, that line is supposed to be there, and that is what you are seeking to protect. But at the same time, I can't help but think of the way we've sort of bifurcated this country along certain lines. I heard Bill O'Reilly on Fox News saying that white males and Christians are under attack in this country. I mean, do you buy that Christians are the ones under attack?
No. And I find it very frustrating. And, you know, Americans United, we work with religious groups all of the time. We work with Baptists, Presbyterians, Unitarians, the UCCs. You know, the list could go on and on. And they all agree with us on this, that actually church-state separation protects religion. And that is one of the reasons why we were one of the most religiously diverse countries in the world. I do not believe that Christians are under an attack. I mean, I tell people I recently, while lobbying, was having a conversation with a legislator in a state who was sort of making that argument. And this was a southern state. And I said, it's amazing to me because the House and the Senate and your governor, they're all the vast majority Christian. And so it is hard for me to understand how Christianity could be under attack when all of the branches are being led by Christians and usually Christian white men.
Talking to Maggie Garrett, Legislative Director for Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Maggie, explain for our listeners why your organization, I assume that you would argue, that if we really want to protect religion, we need to keep it out of government.
Correct. The government shouldn't be telling you how to practice your religion or what you should believe. And if the government is influencing you in some way, that's really taking away your ability to make that decision for yourself. When you're going, you know, for the Greece case, for instance, when you're going before the board and they see you in the audience that you're not standing or participating in the prayer, that might influence their decision and how to affect and how it might, you know, the law might affect you. And so that is influencing you. You can't be your true self because you're afraid of how the government might react to you. And I think it's things like that. You can have your own religious beliefs, but you should be able to you shouldn't be legislating based on them. I shouldn't be restricted in my life based on someone else's religious belief.
But clearly it's not about rooting out religious belief. And again, I know that's one of the boogeymen we hear in this conversation of religion itself is under attack. And that's, my understanding, is not at all the mission of Americans United.
Oh, correct, correct. It, you know, our executive director is a minister. We have actually the person who's in the office next door to me, he works in our field department, and he is a minister and does clergy outreach. Our the president of our board is a rabbi, and so part of what Americans United stands for is that it is people of faith, people who are non-believers, all gather together saying that it is the best interest for everyone to have church-state separation. I actually also tell people all the time that I became a church-state separationist out of influence from my Republican father and my Lutheran pastor. And that is how, that is where my beliefs in church-state separation come from.
And very interesting. When it comes to other legislative priorities for Americans United for Separation of Church and State, what is on your radar now and going into election season and looking at Washington?
I think that we will be seeing in the states and in Congress a lot more refusal bills. Things like the RFRAs, the religious freedom bills that people have been talking about in Indiana and Arkansas, we are seeing some of them very targeted. So it might be targeted to adoption to same-sex couples. It might be targeted towards marriage licenses. Now marriages, you know, if marriage is allowed in your state, well, the judge doesn't have to actually give you a marriage license. And actually, some of them are very drastic. The bills we're seeing in the states range from the judge doesn't have to give you the marriage license to we will fire any judge who gives you a marriage license, which is something that there was a bill like that in Texas. So we'll be following all those sorts of bills. And those will be both in the states on the federal level. We also follow voucher bills. Some people might at first thought think, oh, voucher bills, that's an education issue. Right. Why are you interested in that as a church-state separation organization? And the reason is because the vast majority of the money goes to religious schools. If you look in the D.C. program, it's 80%. In most of the programs, it's 80 to 90% of the money goes to religious schools. And so we look at this really as taxpayer-funded religious education, and that's why we oppose school vouchers. Of course, there's many other reasons to oppose school vouchers, like they don't work. They don't improve education. They're not helping public schools improve at all. So if the argument is public schools have problems, so we should have vouchers, well, all that's doing is taking money out of public schools and not actually fixing any of the problems you're identifying. So there's various reasons to oppose vouchers. But those bills and tuition tax credit bills are all over the states and in Congress as they are trying to reauthorize the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, which is the federal law that gives funds to all K through 12 programs in the states. There's lots of voucher amendments. Rand Paul, Ted Cruz, they're all talking about vouchers. And actually in New York, it's an issue because, and you probably follow some of the New York stuff better than me on this, but the governor has been pushing for a tuition tax credit program, and that has been winding its way through your legislature. And of course, in our view, a tuition tax credit is no different than a voucher. Some people say, well, a voucher is taxpayer money and a tuition tax credit is a tax credit. But really what the state is doing is instead of collecting the money and then giving out as a voucher, they're just foregoing that same amount of money that goes to the private school. So it's really the same exact thing.
There will always be a need or at least a conversation about separation of church and state in this country. I mean, I don't suspect that will ever change. But if there were sort of a sliding scale where one end is church and state are not separated at all and the other end is separation of church and state exactly as you view the founders would have wanted it, mm-hmm. where have we moved in recent years? Are we moving one way or another?
I think we've been moving away from where I would want it. I think that the courts have not been great on this issue. I think that because religion has been so infused into the elections lately, they have been making religion an issue that I think even people who support church-state separation in politics don't really want to talk about. They just don't really want to go there. And so I think we have been losing. However, I think that they might have, at this point, started overreaching to the point where we might be moving back. When you look at Indiana and Arkansas, when you look at some of these bills that are infused by church-state separation, religious freedom ideas on marriage, on healthcare, I think people are starting to get sick of it. And I think that they are realizing that it does cause a lot of harm. And so I'm hoping that this will be a shift back the other way.
Last question. Every time we talk church-state separation on this program, we hear from some listeners who say, invariably, can we just admit we are a Christian country? We've always been a Christian nation. That's what we hear all the time. Not from everyone, but from a few. How do you respond to that when you hear that?
We might have a majority of people in this nation who are Christian, but we are certainly not a Christian nation. That is not the way we were founded. We have secular documents that take pains to say things like there shall be no religious test for office. There shall be, they have the Establishment Clause, which calls for a separation of church and state. I'm sure you also get calls saying church-state separation, those words aren't in the Constitution, which I hear all the time. But the concept of church-state separation is there in the Establishment Clause. In the same way, we would say it doesn't say you have the right to vote in there, but you wouldn't argue that you don't. It doesn't actually say the words fair trial, but clearly the concept of fair trial is in there. The concept of church-state separation is in there. And our founders took pains to make clear that that's the case. And so we're certainly not a Christian nation.
Thanks for taking the time to visit with us on Connections, and enjoy your stay in Rochester.
Thank you so much.
Take a short break, and in our next hour, we are talking anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism on the rise worldwide. A number of studies do confirm this. And even on some American college campuses, anti-Semitism has been an issue. How to find it, how to make sure that what we are talking about is anti-Semitism and not simply legitimate criticism of Israeli policy. That conversation and more next hour on Connections.